Yongdan called from the door, "Arao, Arao. Comrade, you may come." But no one appeared. I felt inclined to believe that wild animals were roaming about, and we threw some stones in the direction where the noise was coming from, but this did not stop it in the least. This confirmed Yongdan in his opinion that human beings and not beasts were there. However, as they did not attack us, we left them to their business and went back into the hut. We barricaded ourselves as well as we could, covered the fire, and lay in a corner where we could not be easily seen or fired at through the gap in the top of the door. That was all that we could do, and in whatever case, when one has done any as best, worries of any kind are superfluous and unwise. Thus reflecting, we fell asleep and slept so soundly that the sun was already high in the heavens when we awakened. We drank a bowl of tea with pleasure, but my tired body cried out for some solid food. This was the sixth day of our fast, and, without appearing too gluttonous, I can confess that we were hungry. Kolog, the first village we were to come upon, was not so near to the hut as the conspirators had told us the day before. We reached it at noon. We had at last arrived amongst these Pippas, heroes of so many strange tales, about whom Yongdan and I had spoken for years. Up till now all had gone well, and we were full of confidence in the future. The village was situated in a narrow valley surrounded by alpine scenery and partly covered with snow. Neither its wooden cottages nor the few people visible had anything especially threatening about them. I felt really safe as to my disguise, after having passed these huge mountain ranges. No one would ever think that a foreign woman had dared to venture on that road. No one would ever suspect the pilgrim tramping over these distant tracks on which a white traveler was never seen. This feeling of security was a great comfort and allowed me to enjoy TBB charm of my adventure more freely. We could not begin our wanderings in the land of Poe in a better way than by going round a begging. It was in accordance both with our program and our present needs. We therefore knocked at the door of the first cottage we found on our road. When we answered the usual question, "Whence have you come?" by saying that we had just crossed the Ainila, the woman who had interrogated us burst into loud exclamations which attracted a few neighbors. How could we have come through the snow? It was a real wonder. And again, the unquestionable protection of our pole and mola came forward. We were invited to sit down and produce our bowls, which were filled with hot soup. Was it good? Was it bad? I could not say. I only felt the inner animal joy of the starving man at his first contact with food, after a long fast. It seemed to me that beings rushed up from the depth of my body toward my mouth to feed upon the thick mixture of tsampa, water, curd, and turnips that I swallowed eagerly. Other good people gave us tsampa and a little butter, and taking our bags in hand we went through the village to continue our begging. We quickly gathered a quantity of tsampa sufficient for 2 days. As we were now in an inhabited country, we could renew our supplies, and did not need to load ourselves with heavy bags. Thus we left Kolog and followed the river downwards. We had left the village, when a strange idea took root in my brain. That soup which we had eaten, the woman had taken it out of a pot standing in a corner behind an open door. Why had that earthen pot been put in such a place? Could it be? No. I revolted at the mere thought of it. And yet in a corner behind the door. I turned toward my companion. "Jalong Lags," I said, very politely, "methinks we have eaten the dog's soup." The lama, who was enjoying the pleasant sensation of excellent digestion, started. "What do you say? What, dog's soup?" I explained to him calmly the particulars on which my suspicion was grounded. He turned pale, the expression of his face reminding me of those one sees among the passengers on a steamer's decks in rough weather. Then, amongst the details of our meal, I remembered that to fill our bowls our benefactress had dipped in the soup a ladle which was hanging near the hearth, with the kitchen utensils. A Tibetan would never touch the dog's soup with the ladle used in cooking. I could therefore be certain that the soup was men's food, and I reassured the trembling lama. "What a fright you have given me," he said, laughing. "What a fool you are," I answered. "Men's or dogs, the soup refreshed you. Why make yourself unhappy and sick over a mere idea? I fear, replied Yongnan, that under your hermit master's guidance you have made too much progress in the Thule Shugsjin. In the future I shall carefully examine the contents of our pot when you make our broth. I hope I shall not have to fill it again with bootle ere the broth as you have done. The good soup that I had so unjustly calumniated kept us jolly. We were proceeding in that gay mood when we saw three well-dressed and handsome men coming towards us across the fields. Long hair falling freely on their shoulders, fur robes, cloth vests in shades of warm green and dark red, beautiful swords with jeweled sheaths stuck in their belts, they looked vaguely like those knights of yore one sees in old paintings. The mystic landscape of fir trees in the background, the clear river, and the narrow path that wound through the fields added still more to the impression. It made me think of the Memling paintings I had seen in my youth in Belgian galleries. They politely requested the Lama to make some mows about the very same affair on which he had already been consulted the day before, in the forest. The men sent after the governor's messenger had not yet come back. Had they caught him, or not? It appeared that the whole country felt greatly concerned about the matter. Yongnan told them that the gods had already been consulted and that it was neither fit nor prudent to trouble them again. Still, he could say that, according to his previous vow, all things would end well. The two knights seemed satisfied, and with a most graceful dignity, went back to their houses nearby. A few minutes later a villager passed us and stopped my companion to ask Amo about some private business, and, as the latter satisfied him, a Lama rode by on a horse and, having alighted, requested the same kind offices from his humble pedestrian colleague. Human credulity, be it in the East or in the West, has no limits. In India, the Brahmins have for centuries kept their countrymen to the opinion that offering presents to those belonging to their caste, and feeding them, was a highly meritorious religious work. Nowadays this cunning old device has taken in its snare the very ones who invented it, and on various occasions Brahmins are compelled by the custom to give gifts to other Brahmins. In the same way, a Tibetan Lama, adept in ritual, cannot perform the magic rites for his own benefit and must rely on the well-remunerated services of a colleague. Hermits, Gompan, alone can escape. Some of them have completely renounced all religious ceremonies, whereas others condescend to oblige the believers who beg their help, but never perform any rites on their own behalf, or ask anyone else to do so. The views of these lonely ascetics and the teachings they impart to those whom they take as disciples are interesting in many respects, and may be a revelation to those who consider Tibet a land of benighted savages. But to return to Yongden, I must say that although they are more numerous and more powerful, as members of the state church, the lamas who belong to the yellow cap sects acknowledge the superiority of their brethren in the various red cap sects in all questions more or less connected with magic and occult science. Humble and dirty as it was, my companion's red hat enjoyed much success. A contribution of tsampa and butter entered our bags as a result of the delivery of these various oracles. Truly the beginning of our adventure in the country of the dreaded Pupas was quite encouraging. We soon entered a narrow, dark gorge, and being tempted by the provisions we carried, we thought of taking a rest for a while, and eating some barley flour and butter. We were already seated on the trunk of a fallen tree when a man passed and advised us to proceed quickly because we were still a long way from the nearest village and the road was anything but safe. Robbers, he said, roamed in the region even during the day and were much more to be feared after dark. The news agreed with what we had been told about Poyul. We started immediately, our revolvers in readiness under our dresses. The sun had set when we reached the end of the gorge. The three wide valleys opened and their very large intersection Wadala entirely cultivated. Farms were seen here and there, and a cluster of houses forming a hamlet. The valley on the opposite side of the river led to Chos Zong, where there is an important lamasery, the very place where the Lhasa Mandate had been stoned. We crossed a bridge, well built, although JT had no breastwork, and were allowed to spend the night in the mill room of a small isolated farm which was extremely clean. As a rule, The place where grain is ground is the cleanest in a Tibetan house, and very often only the inmates are allowed to enter it, for fear lest it be defiled by strangers. Footnote. Professional beggars are more or less considered as impure, although the system of castes does not really exist in Tibet. As for travelers, they may, so think the Tibetans, have come into touch with impure objects or be accompanied by evil spirits. Our hosts sent us a few pieces of dry cow dung to light a fire, but refused to give or even to sell us enough fuel to cook a meal. I went outside, along the river and in the fields, gathering whatever branches I could find. When I came back, Yongdan had some visitors, and the question of the governor, his messenger, the men sent after him, etc. was once more the topic. Other people appeared later on, and requested from our host a contribution in grain to feed a party of armed puppers who were mustering to go somewhere. We were not admitted into confidence as to their destination. It looked as if the country were rising. The next morning some more armed fellows came to the Lama Famos about the governor, who had succeeded in fleeing from Chozong and had taken refuge in another lamasery at Sungzong. Spies of both parties were certainly wandering through the country, such being the Tibetan custom. We might be taken for spies ourselves, and get into trouble. We therefore recrossed the river, and strode away, endeavoring to put Sungzong behind us as soon as possible. Pilgrims returning from the holy Pima Khoichen Mountains called us to drink tea on the road and made us a little present. We again crossed the Polung Tsangpo and proceeding now on its right bank, we entered a narrow gorge where I met with a peculiar accident. I merely knocked my toes against a stone sticking out of the ground and did not hurt them, but felt such terrible pain in the bowels that I nearly fainted. I remained lying on the ground for quite a long time, incapable of standing, and as a comical element was never absent in even our most unpleasant adventures, Yongdan did not dare to throw water on my face when he saw that I was fainting, lest it should remove the accumulated dirt and special makeup that constituted a part of my disguise. The enthusiastic opinion which we formed of the puppers, after our first meeting with them, did not last more than a single day. That evening on emerging from a gorge we saw the valley suddenly widen. A number of farms were scattered over the fields, and near the road, we noticed two or three half-ruined and abandoned houses. I proposed to Yongdan that we stay for the night in one of these tumble-down habitations, but he objected, with reason, that the fire which we should light would attract the attention of the villagers, and that undesirable visitors might call on us. As we thought it imprudent to spend the night alone in the vicinity of the village, we had to beg shelter somewhere, and we thus made a real acquaintance with the Pippa's hospitality. At the first farm a young shepherd left his flocks as soon as he caught sight of us, and ran as for his life, to inform the inmates of the house that Arjipas were coming. Instantly doors and windows were closed and no one answered when we called and shouted outside. All had been done so quickly and so artlessly that it was really amusing. I nearly laughed aloud, but as such gaiety would not have fitted my disguise, I endeavored to appear sad whilst proceeding to another farm. "We were wrong," said Yongdan, "to go to such a small cottage. Poor people have none too much for themselves, and fear the beggars because they have nothing to give. On the other hand, they do not like to refuse alms to a lama pilgrim, for it is a bad deed, so they cleverly managed to avoid seeing him. Did you not notice that they fastened the door and the blinds without looking outside? They may even have made a pretense of not hearing me when I shouted at them, or they may have said amongst themselves, 'Here is one of those rascals fire imitate the lama's way of begging to deceive householders. Of cunning ones are blameless, since they pretend not to knbw that a lama was at their door.' What a wonderful trick! Let us go to a rich farm, at the Chukpos. Rich man, house no one shut the doors, but five big dogs were allowed to attack us freely. While I worked hard with my iron-spiked staff to keep the beasts away, Yongdan endeavored to express his request loudly enough to be heard above the furious barking of animals. Nobody answered at first, then a young woman appeared on the flat roof and asked us many questions, without ordering the dogs to leave us. Yongdan answered with angelic patience, while I continued the fight around him. Her curiosity satisfied, the woman retired inside the upholstery apartment to report to the Nepo about us and our request. This lasted another good 10 minutes, and finally she came back bringing a negative answer. We were not allowed to enter the house. Tibetans, like many other people, are very much like sheep. The traveler may be certain that if he is refused hospitality by one farmer, all the other villagers who may happen to know it will close their doors to him. We had not the least chance of success in the vicinity of the owner of the ferocious dogs. We went away, already resigned to walking a few more hours, and if we did not come to any village on our way, to sleep hidden in the woods. But the last house at the end of the cultivated area happened to present a good appearance. Just as we passed, a woman opened the door of the cattle pen to let the cows in. Yongdan begged that we might be helped to stay inside the farm until the next morning. As he was speaking with her, another woman appeared at a window, and he repeated his request. The answer was that the permission of the master of the house was needed, and that she would ask him. After a while, the same woman came down with a plate of tsampa, sent by the Nepo, who did not wish to receive us. We do not ask tsampa, explained Yongdan. We only want netang. We will eat our own food and trouble nobody for alms. Let us only come inside. The woman returned upstairs with the flour, and very probably the fact that we had refused it inclined the Nepo to believe in our respectability. We were admitted into an exceedingly clean and well-built room such as I have seen only in the dwellings of quite upper-class Tibetans. A servant lighted the fire and gave us a plentiful supply of wood. Our opinion of the pipas, which had fallen very low after the experiences at the other farms, rose a little. We cooked some soup, and while eating it we had an interesting talk about the economical and political conditions of the country with a man who belonged to another part of Tibet, but who had settled in Poyul. The Nepo came also with several women, and Yongdan had to comply with the usual requests for Mose. One of the women noticed a turquoise which the Lama had hung to the rosary he wore around his neck. Like coral and pearl, turquoise is a very prized part of Tibetan jewelry. But what goes under the name of yew, turquoise, in Tibet is seldom genuine. It is mostly polished malachite, or even some gross imitation made in China. The stone in Yongdan's rosary was of a pretty color. It greatly pleased the women, who examined it again and again. Finally one of them wished to buy it, but with the cunning of peasants in every country, she tried to take advantage of our apparent needy condition to acquire it practically for nothing, and her friends did their utmost to help her. It was quite amusing to hear them talking about imaginary dangers, thieves along the road which we were to follow, and how food would be more useful to poor travelers than a useless precious stone. There was no one amongst them who did not recognize the spiritual superiority of an ordained Lama. They would not have failed to ask his services in case of illness, death, or epidemic among the cattle. They would have called on him to bless the harvest or the house, and to make Mose a butt. Nevertheless, they endeavored, with all the cleverness they possessed, to cheat the poor Holy One delivered by fate, as they believed, into their hands. The Lama refused to accept the price offered, and as I knew that he had inherited some really fine turquoises on his father's death, I thought that this was one of them which he was carrying with him. Was it the talk about robbers, or the many mows he had made, or other causes that troubled Yongdan's sleep? I was suddenly awakened in the night by a rather loud exclamation. "Where is the gun?" said the Lama. "They have taken my gun." And some incomprehensible muttering followed. At first I did not realize that he was dreaming aloud. I quickly extended my hand toward the two revolvers which we had, as usual, hidden with our money under the tent spread over us as a blanket in Tibetan fashion. I have already said that poor Tibetan travelers do not undress to sleep. The covering allowed us to part with our heavy belts containing the money. When we thought it unsafe to use it for fear that so much cloth might awake our host's cupidity and thus endanger our safety, we were compelled to keep these belts, as well as our arms, under our dresses. Their weight on the breast during a whole night was, I need scarcely say, most tiring and unpleasant. It often prevented me from sleeping. Our revolvers and belts were there, but the young man continued to speak aloud. There were two people beside ourselves in the room, the strange man and his poor wife. Our companions might awake, throw a piece of resinous wood on the fire to get a light to see what was the matter. Even if convinced that the lama was dreaming, they might persuade themselves that his dream had roots in something real and that we were really hiding a gun. Knowing the passion of all Tibetans for firearms, I was afraid that anything might happen if our hosts happened to suspect that we owned one. To what extreme means would they not go to secure it? I gently pushed the dreamer, but it was no use. He continued to twaddle about the gun. I then crawled close to him and shook him, whispering in his ear to be quiet. The poor fellow was tired and enjoyed the sound sleep of youth. He did not awake, although he opened his eyes. I gave him a slap. I blew on his face. I did not know what to do to silence him. At last he turned on one side and ceased his muttering. Already our companions moved in their corner. I took our belts and the revolvers, and buckled them all hastily under my dress, so that no sign of them could be seen if one made a light and came over to us to inquire about the meaning of the noise. I did not dare to sleep three again, and watched Yongd until a little before daybreak, when he awakened. While we were drinking our morning tea, two women came again to try to buy the turquoise, and after we had taken leave and were proceeding on our way, the one who wanted it ran after the lama with a small piece of butter and some champa. Still thinking that the was one of his genuine stones, I scoffed at the silly female who believed that she could acquire a beautiful stone at such small expense. But in order to prevent any of her male relatives or friends from following us with the desire of getting the precious jewel still cheaper, I added, "My son is a Pyutalong. He forgets too often that his father was a Nagspa, as his elder brother still is in our country. That you has been hung on his father's Tortrenga, and anyone who is not connected with the Ngags will find to his cost the result of wearing it. All but an initiated Nagspa, or a Nagspa's near relative, is Namitheta to it, and would die if he became its owner." This was sufficient to cool the coquettish person. She understood that the turquoise was definitely out of her reach. Perhaps she considered herself lucky to have been informed of the danger of wearing it. Perhaps, at the bottom of her heart, she regretted the niggardliness which had prevented her from acquiring it, when she could have hung the sky blue stone at her ear or on her neck without suspecting its origin. She went silently away, carrying back with her the butter and the champa. "Feet, why should you sell your turquoise?" I asked Yongdan. "We do not need money. It is better to keep it and give it, later on, to one of your relatives. A peculiar expmian meaning that one is not worthy of the object of which he use, and that he cannot bear a special power or dignity." "They do not care for such you," he answered, laughingly. "What, they do not like turquoise?" "Yes, they do genuine ones. But this, it is an imitation from China. The champa and butter would have been a good price for it. And I had taken it as genuine, as, of course, had the woman at the farm. Anyhow, that kind of fun was not to be repeated. It would have been too absurd to get into trouble with robbers, and be killed for a supposed precious stone of which one could purchase about a pound for less than 20 cents. The turquoise was therefore removed from the rosary. Chapter 6. Having crossed a dense forest, we reached the neighborhood of Sung Zong a few days later. A reading of the whole Kajua had taken place in a village, at the conclusion of which the 108 big volumes, loaded on yaks, were taken back to the monastery by a few country folk. Amongst these an old woman ambled leisurely, walking at a slack pace before her hairy bullock, which enjoyed an occasional graze. The good grandmother chatted with us, and seeing that I was eating dried champa as I went along, she produced a piece of bread out of her anfaga and gave it to me. Who could tell in what strange and dirty places that bread had been? Of course, I could not refuse it, and I was even compelled to make a pretense of eating it. But the first morsel was far from being unpalatable, quite the contrary. I quickly overcame my disgust, and with the solid appetite of a wayfarer I ate the last crumb of it. We came upon Sung Zong as I was finishing this rustic delicacy. Groups of houses forming hamlets were scattered hither and thither. The lamasery itself stood isolated on the Sneol hillock, between the Po and Nagong rivers. The latter emerges from a valley that opens behind the lamasery, and the ranges which bound it. This provides a commanding background for the insignificant buildings of the large monastery. Although Sungsong is one of the most important places of the Po country, and is of considerable geographical interest, being at the junction of two large rivers, it has not yet been charted on the maps. The whole region is still terra incognita to geographers, and I could not but deeply regret that the odd disguise I had been compelled to assume prevented me from gathering the few observations that my modest ability would have allowed me to make. In all my travels, including this last journey, I have been uncommonly successful in my search for documents pertaining to the field of my own studies, and I should have been glad to do something that would prove of interest to others in different fields of knowledge. If I have failed, the fault is not mine. During the whole period of my stay in Chinese Tibet, my movements were closely watched by the spies of the border posts. The Lhasa officials in charge of them had received strict orders to prevent me from entering the part of Tibet under British influence. My small baggage, containing some instruments and requisites for plain scientific work, which I had once tried to smuggle into the country, led to my detection, and I was stopped on my way. Under such circumstances, it only remained for me to start as I did, empty-handed. I enjoyed too much these months of free life to entertain unkind feelings toward those who forced upon me the hardships and dangerous risks of my pilgrimage as a beggar. I feel rather grateful to them for having led me to that wonderful experience. Yet one cannot but lament the fact that such efforts are hindered and not allowed to bear their full fruit. It is beyond the scope of the present book to deal with geographical matters. Nevertheless, a few words may be of interest. I have already mentioned that the region around the upper course of the River Po is unsurveyed. Maps mistake the Nagong for it, but the former has its source farther to the southeast. No one is to be blamed for this error, as no white traveler has ever gone up the river higher than Shoa, which is situated far from Sungsong, downstream. If I am not mistaken, only one English officer has visited the former place. The Nagong springs from the foot of a small pass, near a monastery called Dugang, in the range that divides the basin of the Salween from that of the Brahmaputra. On the opposite side of the pass flows Dzogchen River, which joins the Salween. As the Nagong is an important stream, some might like to discuss the question as to which of the two rivers that unite at Sungsong is the main one, and which is the tributary. But the natives have answered this definitely. The river formed by the three streams which I discovered on my way to Po Yul they call the Po. One of these three comes, as I have said, from the Po Gotsa Pass, above Sungsong. The River Po receives two important tributaries emerging from wide valleys, the upper one leading to Chozong and the second in the direction of Chundo, where is situated the parent monastery of the two large lamaseries of Chozong and Sungsong. The maps of that region, which have been drawn from reports and not actual surveys, indulge in many fancies which are faithfully copied in successive editions. Amongst them is the invention of a town called Pozong. In reality, Pozong means the fortress of the Po country. It is a title rather than a name, almost like our own word capital. But the Pupas do not agree as to which of their towns is entitled to bear it, while the people of Pomt, the lower Po, declare that Pozong is Shoa, where the king of Po has his residence. The inhabitants of Potod, the upper region, extending downstream along the river Po as far as Dashin, affirm that the Pozong is Chundo. This is not the only peculiarity offered by the maps of Tibet. In fact, in most parts of the north and the east they are of but little use to travelers, if indeed they are of any use at all. The names written on them seldom correspond to those one hears from the natives. The rivers and mountain ranges are not really in the places they are shown to be, and a number of them are completely ignored, as are also the roads with the exception of a few main tracks. Geographers are quanted on that side of the globe, geographers and other scientists. for I doubt if any land is more wonderful than that unknown and still forbidden Tibet. The most annoying but unavoidable necessity of revictualling delay dusat sung zong.